Hello and welcome to Fly With Your Shadow, back after an unexpectedly long absence. I'm Jeff Robson, and this show comes to you from my home in Winnipeg, Manitoba. This podcast was originally designed as a place to have conversations specifically about mental illness and mental health and the devastating effects of the COVID pandemic. While those topics are still a major focus, still important, in order to incorporate a wider range of guests and have a whole lot of new conversations, we're going to hear some stories about the lives of people making music, their challenges, struggles, insecurities, and a whole lot more. There's a bit of a stigma around the lives of musicians sometimes. People often have this mistaken notion that their lives are one big party and their jobs aren't hard work. In reality, nothing could be farther from the truth. The pressures and uncertainties of a life in music can be among the most stressful imaginable, but somehow artists are able to persevere and create meaningful and powerful art. My goal is to help you get to know the people behind some of my favorite music and help you to understand their lives and get a sense of how they do what they do. On this episode, we'll get to know someone who came to my attention and burst onto the scene on the strength of his second album in 2016 and has since put out two more incredibly strong albums that have become real favorites of mine. You'll get used to it, babe. You'll get
used to that honest life. Yeah, my name is Ken Yates. I'm a singer-songwriter from... Originally from London, Ontario, but I now live in a small town called Creemore, just outside of Collingwood, Ontario, about an hour and a half north of Toronto, and yeah, that's about it. Just been making music for over a decade now, which seems crazy. And life is like a cheap wine. Don't get
Ken Yates is about to embark on a tour that'll bring him back to Winnipeg for the first time in a number of years on October 15th with Jada Kelly. You can find out more at kenyates.com or find links, samples, and more info at flywithyourshadow.com. You get used to it, babe. Used to not feeling all right. How did you get into music? What sort of taught you or told you that this was going to be the career for you?
Yeah, I kind of weirdly always knew it. Like my parents put me in piano lessons, and then I quickly asked them to take guitar lessons, and just kind of became obsessed with the guitar and kind of knew I wanted to do it for a living. And I didn't really know what that meant because I was mostly just sitting in my basement playing guitar. But I love music, and kind of on a whim, my dad actually took me down to Boston to audition for Berklee College of Music, and somehow got in. I don't know how I got in still, but anyways, that was kind of where I figured out what I wanted to do, and took some songwriting courses and met a lot of artists that I still work with today down there, and that's kind of where I found my community of artists and really fell in love with songwriting, and the rest is history. Yeah, kind of snowballed from there.
So was it always a singer-songwriter sort of focus for you, or did you go through the punk phase, or like who were kind of your influences? Who taught you that this was your path?
Yeah, well, it's funny because I didn't really have a lot of, I didn't really play with any musicians growing up in London. It was sort of just I would kind of just listen to what my dad listened to, just kind of classic rock radio, and I would sit in the basement and, I'd learn Zeppelin songs or whatever, and then eventually that kind of graduated to some more like modern music, like Radiohead, and it wasn't until I got to Berklee that I found some artists who, shared music with me that I wasn't familiar with, and that kind of became my musical discovery. So I was a bit of a late bloomer in that term, but I went there just as a guitar player and didn't really sing much. Kind of sang on my own, but didn't consider myself a singer. And then once I started writing songs, I sort of had in mind that I would just be a writer, like maybe a co-writer, or, I kind of due to the Nashville model of just kind of being a guy behind the scenes, and quickly realized that nobody was going to sing my songs. So I started singing them on my own, and got a decent reaction from that, and just kind of out of necessity started singing my own songs. So yeah, it wasn't really a thing that I set out to do until about like my early 20s. And then I really just became obsessed with writing songs and just wanted to write as much as possible. And that kind of naturally turned into the singer-songwriter thing, because that was the easiest path available, was to just jump in the car with my acoustic guitar and go out and start booking shows.
Yeah. I don't know if I know very many singer-songwriters who went to school for music per se, that certainly went to Berkeley. I mean, it's obviously a school that we've all heard of, but I don't think of it, and obviously it's my ignorance, but I think of it more as a jazz school or something. Is there a sort of a path for learning what you do now, or do you have to sort of learn other types of music and then apply it to what you do now?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, because you're right, it is kind of a jazz school, and it's not really, it isn't really like a place where you can go and become a singer-songwriter. And there is this kind of a stigma around it, which I'm always like nervous to tell people that I'm a Berkeley grad, because there is this stigma of like, I don't know, like you come out of there with, as a bit of a noodler, a jazz guy or a shredder, But for me, I was just kind of I was one of those rare cases where I sort of needed those 4 years just to kind of figure out what kind of musician I wanted to be and what I wanted to do and what a career in music looked like. Whereas a lot of the other people who went to Berkeley were already very polished. They knew what they wanted to do. Some of them didn't really need those 4 years to be there. It was kind of just a jumping off point for them. Whereas I just sort of needed this community and space to find myself. But yeah, so I'm not really a typical Berkeley student, because I kind of just went there as a pretty green. As I say, I'm shocked I even got in the first place.
So, I mean, you obviously didn't have a lot of confidence then, if you didn't have any real musical experience and you didn't even really sort of intend to do this as a career. It's got to be tough being thrown in with people who are, I would think, would have already by that point have more experience than you and whatever. Was that intimidating for you? Did you feel like you were out of place?
Oh, definitely. I think I felt out of place for the first 3 years there. yeah. I mean, I took all these different courses just trying to find, like I took a bunch of jazz courses and I even took like a guitar, like shredder class, like I just tried all these different genres and it wasn't really clicking with me. And I was by no means like, one of the better guitar players there. Like they give you a rating when you first get there. And I think the highest rating is an 8. And I came in there with I think the highest I got by the time I left was a 2. So like my technical skills were not impressing anybody. So yeah, I was kind of lost for a while there, and it was a great place to be, but it was definitely intimidating and definitely just didn't really have much of a direction, until I just kind of took a songwriting course on a whim. And I thought like, oh, they'd just go over the basics of songwriting, that we would listen to popular songs and just kind of dissect what's going on. And turns out like within the first week they were asking us to bring in a song and play it for the class. And I had never even written a song. So that was kind of the kickstarter for me to just really dig in and start writing. And it was absolutely terrifying. I was totally terrified. And I wrote a lot of bad songs and kind of avoided even bringing them to class. I was sort of the guy at the back of the class who would just wait till the very last minute until his name was called to play something. And eventually I brought one in that people seemed to think wasn't terrible. And again, I just kind of became obsessed with it. I met a lot of other songwriters and we all took it very seriously. And, that was kind of the first real community that I found. Like, I met all these like sensitive songwriter types and I was like, these are my people, man.
And so was it, obviously they kind of, when they reacted to that song and some of those early songs, that had to kind of give you some idea of what to work on or what was working for you already at that point. Did that really help you to kind of chisel off some of the rough edges pretty quickly, getting feedback from other songwriters as opposed to, most of the songwriters I talk to, they go out and play them a million times and they kind of get feedback from stage, but you're getting them from I would assume, a pretty tough crowd of other songwriters in a way.
Yeah, I mean, that was the best and the worst thing about it was that it was terrifying to play, you know, to 30 other songwriters plus a teacher, you know, or professor, songwriting professor, and have them dissect your song. So, I mean, that was great for me in terms of, like, you know, once I went out and actually started playing them live, it felt easy because I had been sharing them in, you know, in these pretty tough environments for so long. But yeah, getting that instant feedback, but also kind of being inspired by these other songwriters. Like, I was taking classes with songwriters I still work with and love today. That's where I met one of my best friends, Brian Dunn, there, and he was already writing amazing songs. And my friend Liz Longley, she was writing these incredible songs, and they just kind of inspired me to really work at it. And I remember I took this stage performance class, and I waited till the last day of the semester to get up and play a song, and I would just hide in the back, just kind of hoping nobody would call me. And eventually the professor noticed me and was like, "I don't think you've played anything for 3 months or whatever." And so I reluctantly got up there and actually played one of the songs from my first record called "I Don't Want to Fall in Love." And got a really, really great reaction. And the professor even asked me to come out and play a few shows. And so that was kind of like this huge validating moment for me that, like, oh, there's obviously something is working. I don't know what it is, but I'm going to keep doing this for a while.
So do you remember, like, I got to assume that in that community, there's a lot of, I don't know, are there open mic nights or are there showcase nights for students or what's the deal? Like, where do you start actually playing these for people who aren't just at school with you?
Yeah. I mean, there was a bit of that. I remember we had some like songwriters nights. I remember there was a Canada night. that was one of the first shows I ever played my original music at was Canada night at Berkeley. And so there were a few things like that, but again, I was such a late bloomer. I kind of found my groove in my last semester there, my fourth year. So really it all happened very quickly. And then I graduated and moved to New York and kind of hit the ground running from there, just booked as many shows as possible. And yeah, that's kind of where I really started playing live.
How long were you in New York for? Like, what was that, that like?
Yeah, I was there for a couple of years. It was tough. They were a tough couple of years. Like Berkeley is great for this kind of nurturing environment, but it doesn't really teach you about a lot of the other parts of being, you know, being a DIY artist, which, you know, at the time that's kind of what you had to do. So, you know, I had no idea how to book shows or, you know, how to tour properly. And like, I knew I wanted to tour, but I didn't really know how to make that happen. So I would just book as many shows in New York as possible and no one would ever come. And cause you know, I would book a different venue every night and hope people would come. And, so yeah, it was a tough place to be. And I didn't really last very long there, but I did start, that's kind of where I started learning how to tour, and luckily had a few friends who were a bit further along. My friend Liz Longley was having me, open for her. And that was kind of a huge learning experience just to see, you know, how she did it and how she made it work and how you could actually, you know, make a living as a self-represented artist. And yeah, so that's kind of that was a big learning experience. And then I didn't last very long there. I ended up back in Toronto pretty quick soon after that.
Well, why, like, were you avoiding coming to Toronto? Why choose New York? Wouldn't it have been easier just to come and do all those things in Toronto?
Yeah, would have. Definitely would have. I mean, I moved to New York because a bunch of my friends were moving down there. And that was kind of the thing, right? Like, you got to, I think in all of our heads, you have to pick one of the big cities. You got to pick New York, Nashville, or LA. And New York was kind of the place where most of my friends were moving down to. And I lived with these three roommates who were all like pop songwriters, which was just a terrible place to live. My girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, she had moved to Toronto. And so that was a big, big reason why I ended up kind of slowly moving back to Canada. But yeah, in hindsight, it would have been fine just to move, back straight back to Canada. But you know, I was it was good. It was good for me to start. It, what's funny is I started touring in the U.S. before I did in Canada at all. So yeah, it's kind of did it backwards. But in hindsight, it turned out to be a good thing because, you know, still to this day, I seem to have a better audience in the U.S. versus Canada. So I'm just kind of running with that.
Well, exactly. It's so hard for so many of my Canadian songwriter friends to build an audience in the States. You know, they've already kind of worked it here back and forth so many times, and then breaking into the States seems so scary. I guess if you do it in the beginning when you're scared in the first place, then it probably becomes a little easier.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I didn't even think about it at the time, right? And, you know, I was living down there, so I had to get a visa. So I figured that stuff all out. And in hindsight, that was amazing because, you know, I know that's a big hurdle for a lot of Canadian artists is just getting the visa to tour down there. So, yeah, in hindsight, it was great. It was good to do that way.
So it sounds like, I mean, I certainly know Liz Longley, and she kind of burst out of the gate and started doing big things right away. Do you see your friends succeeding, and does that make it harder for you, or does that make you want to work harder to maybe catch up to what they're doing? Or
yeah, I mean, honestly, that's it's the best thing, seeing your friends out there doing stuff, and it's, you know, it's equal parts motivating. And, you know, I used to get like a little bit jealous, like it used to drive me crazy, but I've since matured and now I love seeing them do well. And it honestly just, it's, that's what drives me, right? Is, you know, my friend Brian, he still lives in New York, Brian Dunn, and he sends me his songs. He's the first person that I send my songs to, and vice versa, when I've just finished something. And so if he sends me a new song and it's great, like there's nothing that makes me want to pick up a guitar more than hearing a great song from him. And it's like, it is this really, really motivating factor. And just, you know, I think we're 13 years out of graduating, and the fact that we're still, you know, sharing songs with each other and playing shows with each other. I think, you know, that's kind of what I always wanted. I think growing up in London, just, I wanted that community. So I don't think I would even be doing this if it wasn't for that community, because I was kind of the late bloomer. So it was really them who kind of took me under their wings and said like, no, you need to keep doing this. This is, you're good at this. So don't stop. So, and they still do that today. Cause I, you know, you should see my email thread with Brian. It's just like every song I send him is like, does this suck?
tell me about the process then of going and making that first record. It was, I guess 23 was the first one, was it?
Yeah. 23 was the first one.
That's
yeah.
In 2013.
Yeah. I guess it came out in 2013.
What's it like now taking these songs and making a record?
I mean, that record was, I had met a producer that I went to Berkeley with, and he kind of, again, he sort of met me in a, I think we met in class, and he kind of said like, I'm trying to be a producer. Would you be up for working together and, you know, just trying some stuff. And that was kind of my first intro to any of that. I had no idea what it was like to be in the studio and to make a record. So that record was just kind of a learning experience for me, and figuring out, you know, what kind of artist I wanted to be, how I wanted to sound, how to even make a record, you know, like I didn't even know you could get in a studio and sing a bunch of vocal takes and like cut them all together if you wanted to, you know, like I was so green.
So that record, having, you know, now it's been it's been a while since this record came out, 2013. Yeah, so it's been out for 10 years. When you look back at that record, and obviously, I mean, having heard your other records since then, there's been a lot of growth. Does it make you cringe at all? Or are you still proud of the songs and the performances on there?
I mean, no. I mean, it makes me cringe. I am proud of it in a way, because I still, you know, I think you know, you can hear that, like, I had the tools. I had the ability to write a song. But when I listen to it now, I just kind of hear an artist who doesn't really know what he wants to sound like or what he wants to write about, which makes sense because I was just getting into it. I was just kind of learning. And so, you know, it makes me cringe. And that album's actually not on, it's not on any of the major streaming sites anymore. But, you know, I still, if people ask, sometimes people ask me for it and I'll send them a download link to it or something. But I have tried to remove it from existence.
I was going to ask about that. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, the first one that came to my attention, and I guess a lot of people's, was Huntsville. And it came to my attention for a couple of reasons. Number one, as soon as I see the name Jim Bryson attached to something, my ears perk up. He's been a friend and I'm his biggest fan for a long, long time. So I know that, he doesn't make bad records. So I know that if he's willing to work with you, it must be something. But then right away, didn't you win like a Canadian Folk Music Award with this record too, out of nowhere?
Yeah, that one. Yeah. It won two Canadian Folk Music Awards a year after it came out. And yeah, it was a total shock to me.
Well, I'm not going to lie. It was a total shock to me too. So I often get asked to, I often get asked to adjudicate these things. And at the time, I think they were still sending me CDs at that time. So I'd get all these records and, you know, I kind of make two piles, the ones that I already know, and I know I'm going to like, and then a bunch that, I know I'm not going to like. And then there's some in the middle that go, what is this? And yours definitely landed in the what is this pile, because I didn't know your name, but it's a great looking record and it's got Jim Bryson producing it. So there's got to be something there. And it was just one of those ones that kind of grabbed me right away and really impressed me right away. I mean, you certainly had my vote for that one. But again, I'd never heard your name before that contest, I don't think. So did that... Did you find other people getting to know you through that? Did that kind of open any doors for you with that?
I mean, I don't really, I'm not sure how to answer that. I don't know if any doors opened from it, because I feel like I'm still getting the same reactions today from three records later, which is like, I didn't know who you were. And so, yeah, saw you work with Jim for the third time. But no, I mean, it was amazing. Again, it came as a total shock. I think the category I was in was with like Stephen Fearing and Oh Susanna and Amelia Curran. So I went to the awards hadn't planned a speech or anything. I just assumed I was going to lose, and I was just really happy to be nominated. And yeah, I was in total shock when they called my name. As anyone can attest to my speech, I've never experienced what it's like to be in shock, and I was definitely in shock. So yeah, I mean, it was just that validation, I think, for me, which has like all the kind of pivotal moments, all the milestones for me have just been those kind of moments of validation where you go like, well, clearly, you know, something's working here, and people seem to be digging it. So that's kind of what's kind of just propelled me to keep going with it. And certainly working with Jim was how, you know, I ended up kind of finding what I, you know, think is the sound that I have always been searching for in these past few records.
Well, I mean, tell me, how did you get connected with Jim? I mean, did you know of him or his resume at the time? Did you seek him out? He seems to find people on his own sometimes. Like, how did you get connected and what did you know about him at the time?
Yeah, I kind of searched him out. I had loved his solo records. I loved the record he made with the Weaker Thens, and obviously knew him from working with Catherine Edwards, and so I just kind of I approached him, and I had also known, you know, with 23, my first record, it's very that record is very kind of clean sounding. It's very very folky, and that was just kind of, I felt like that that was the sound of that record because that's what my producer wanted to sound like and not necessarily me. And so Jim, I knew I was a fan of his songwriting and I was a fan of how his record sounded. So I kind of knew that he would have a different approach with me and kind of, you know, offer that more contemporary sound, which is what I was looking for in the time. And which is funny because with Huntsville, now I listen back and it's a very folky record, but now I made three with Jim, and I've kind of let him do his thing a bit more. Whereas with Huntsville, I kind of held him back a little bit. But
oh yeah, you didn't want too much of his his thumbprint on it, or
well, I mean, I think I thought, you know, any of his like synth ideas, or, you know, Jim comes up with these amazing sounds, and I guess I just thought at the time that, that, you know, anything above just a, you know, rhythm section with guitars would start stepping on my songs and stepping on my lyrics. I've since learned that that is not true at all, because it's still me playing and singing, and no matter what you add to it, it's still going to sound like me, right? So so I've since, you know, kind of let Jim loose a little more, which I love. You know, I love the sounds he comes up with, and, you know, it's not like we're making these avant-garde records, but I think at the time I just was worried, like, no, you know, don't step on the song too much.
So I mean I guess talk about the growth or the differences between those records. Like what do you feel has changed, or what does that growth look like to you in those records that you've made with Jim?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I mentioned, I kind of fell into this folky sound because it was kind of the path available to me, you know, jumping in my Honda Civic with my acoustic guitar and playing private shows and house concerts. And that was how I made a living for a while. And then I kind of realized, you know, after we made Huntsville, that I had never really listened to folk music. And so with the next two records, it was kind of about finding that, I think just searching for that sound, which, when I listen to my first two records, I still hear an artist that's just kind of figuring out what he wants to sound like. And with these last two, with Quiet Talkers and Cerulean, I feel like, you know, I've really found the blend between, you know, that typical kind of singer-songwriter style, but having those more contemporary influences there that I grew up listening to. Yeah, I think one day I just kind of realized, you know, maybe it'd be fun to play with a band with an electric guitar, and not just travel around and play in people's houses with my acoustic guitar.
Interesting. And something I noticed, and I don't know whether it was intentional or not, but so the first two records, your picture's not on there. I mean, you're inside, I guess, the first one, but not in a big way. And then Quiet Talkers, you're right out in front there. And then what's the deal with the cover for Cerulean anyway? Can you explain this to me? Because I don't know if I get it yet.
It's okay. A lot of people don't get it. Yeah. I don't even know if I get it. It's just, okay. I had this photo basically I created like a SoundCloud folder with the demos for that record. And that was what I was sending around to Jim and to the band that was playing on the record. And so we got in the studio and they were all like, man, I love that album cover. And you know, I was like, no, that's definitely not going to be the album cover. And I kind of kept it in there, and then I started shopping the record around. And you know, the people that were listening to it in the music industry kept saying, I love that album cover. And it just kind of grew on me to the point where I just really couldn't find anything that I liked better. It just kind of had this, it has this thing that, I can't really explain. It's just kind of a vibe, and there's a lot going on in the picture, and I just kind of love the vibe of it. I wish I had a better answer for you, but I was shocked when I actually pulled the trigger on making it the cover. But
yeah, it definitely stands out. Let's put it that way. But what's the context? Just out of curiosity, like, is this where does this photo come from? How does this exist?
Oh yeah. Well, my dad has this cabin up in Northern Ontario, which we never go to in the winter because it's not insulated, and it's a real pain to get to. But we actually decided one winter we would see what it's like up there in the winter, and we snowshoed in, my wife and I and my family, and so that was us sitting in the cabin. I think we got the cabin up to like -5. That's how warm we could get it. So we're just sitting there freezing our asses off, and that was, somebody just snapped a photo. So, yeah, that was the context behind the photo.
Yeah, it's pretty great, and it certainly stands out, like I say. So that's pretty fun.
You know what? It's funny. Yeah, you just can't like you can try to do a photo shoot to try to capture something that is natural, and you just never can, right? So I always end up using photos where, you know, they were taken in kind of a more candid environment versus trying to go out and create the album artwork.
So while we're on the topic of Jim Bryson, like, do you ask him kind of other questions about the career or anything? Like, what kinds of things do you learn from a guy like that with such experience in so many areas? I mean, other than, you know, putting his sound on the record, what kinds of things do you pick up from him?
Oh man, I mean, I picked up a lot, especially with this last record. With Cerulean, I had written these songs and recorded them before I'd ever played them live, which was kind of backwards from how I did it before. I would have played the new songs like a million times before I went into the studio. So my first tour with Cerulean, I found myself just kind of trying to figure out how to even play these songs. I wrote them all in this really low drop C tuning. And I would go out and try to play these on an acoustic guitar, and like a plugged in acoustic guitar with these drop tunings just sounded awful. And so, you know, it was Jim's guitars that I was playing on the record. So they're his guitars and they're kind of his tone. And he really kind of helped me figure out, you know, how to take the sound of that record and emulate it in a live format, especially if I'm playing solo. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say I'm just ripping off his sound, you know. he got me hooked up with kind of his pedal setup, and, you know, I bought a Jaguar and a Jazzmaster, and so I'm basically playing with the Jim Bryson setup and giving away all his secrets, but yeah. But no, he's been super helpful just finding that, and you know, I feel like that's made a huge difference with my live show now, is not just, you know, being up there with an acoustic guitar for an hour and a half. You know, there's a lot more going on now. So yeah, I've got him to thank for that for sure.
Something else that's interesting on the latest record, you didn't really have a lot of notable special guests, I guess, out in front on the first few records, but this one it's stacked with them. You got some incredible female talent. Obviously you got a couple of friends of Jim's on here, and Kathleen Edwards and Carolyn Marie Brooks. I know he's worked a lot with them, but you also brought in, you got Liz Longley, you got Stephanie Lambring, who's been on this show before, you got Katie Pruitt. What's the impetus for bringing all those folks in, and how do you make that fit in and not just be like, you know, Tony Bennett's duets or something? How is it still, it's still you, you know, how do those people fit in and not wreck your thing or not stand out unnaturally?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it kind of just happened naturally. I wish I had a more interesting answer, but I didn't really intend to have so many, you know, guest singers. I knew I wanted a lot of these songs to have that female vocal on them, just because I love how it blends with my voice. We did actually, I had a couple of male singers sing on a couple songs, and I always find with two male voices it starts sounding a little yacht rocky. So I took them out and replaced them with a female voice. But yeah, it all happened naturally. Like Kathleen obviously lives close to Jim, and she was around and willing to come into the studio. And then Liz Longley, obviously we go way back, and she sings on most of my records, I think. So we had her on. Caroline Brooks was in the studio with Jim at the same time I was working on a record. So that kind of just worked out. And yeah, Stephanie and Katie, we had just been chatting. We'd actually never met, and we'd just been chatting back and forth over the pandemic, and it was just kind of a way to collaborate. And I think that's why it all came together like that. Was I think everyone was just kind of looking to collaborate with each other, and everyone has these home setups now, and it's pretty easy just to send a song over to someone, and they can, you know, send you a vocal back in a couple of hours. So it was kind of a fun way to make. You know, because Jim and I did a lot of this record remotely too, so it was just a fun way to collaborate with other artists.
Tell me about your experience of the of that pandemic time. I guess was that because you had just sort of started really, I guess, building your career and getting some momentum, and then all of a sudden you had to kind of stop for a couple of years. Was that hard for you?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't great. yeah, it was a tough couple of years, as it was for everybody. Yeah, I mean, I definitely felt like I was building some momentum with Quiet Talkers, and I think I, you know, canceled 30 to 40 tour dates that I had lined up. But, you know, everybody was in the same boat, and it did allow me to, you know, my wife and I moved out to the country then and got a bigger space, and, you know, Jim actually lent me a bunch of mics, and so I kind of figured out a home studio setup. And that was actually really nice for me to just be home and be creative. And that's kind of when Cerulean was written. And, you know, I wrote it, but I really struggled writing for the first few months of the pandemic, and then wrote this record really fast. And it was just kind of nice to be creative without, you know, thinking about much, without having a plan or any idea of, you know, who this record was for. I was just kind of enjoying the writing process. So, but yeah, it was, you know, it was tough, but yeah.
The record itself kind of comes from a dark place. I mean, on your website, you said you used to go searching for the darkness. With this record, the darkness found you first, and this was you finding your way out of it. Can you talk at all about that? Like, what you mean by that? What was going on?
Yeah, well, my mom was also sick at the time. She was battling cancer, in kind of the depths of COVID. So that was a tough time for sure. Just dealing with that during the pandemic. And, so a lot of those songs are kind of, you know, they're coming from a very personal place of just me in that time frame dealing with that. And, but it's also, again, like, I think that's where I kind of discovered, the music I want to continue making, in the future, because I feel like my songwriting for the first few records just came from a place of an observer, kind of more of a wallflower, and just kind of writing about other people and other people's experiences. And Cerulean for me was the first time that it came from almost a purely personal place. And honestly, I really just enjoyed that writing process more. So it's something that I'm trying to do more of in the future. I mean, I'm happy to say that the next batch of songs are a little bit more more hopeful than Cerulean, because there's definitely, you know, there's a darkness to that record for sure. But I think I was just writing for me and not thinking about, you know, what was cool or what people wanted to hear or what was good. You know, I was just kind of writing, just writing for myself. And I think, you know, I personally think that turned into my best batch of songs, and just making the record with Jim was a huge relief from everything that was going on. And I really looked forward to even just working remotely with him. Just, you know, we would just like get on Zoom and share guitar ideas back and forth and stuff. And like, that was just a really cool distraction from everything. And so it ended up being a really enjoyable record to make considering what was going on.
I mean, even with some dark and difficult subject matter, you have such a wonderful way with melody. You've obviously been raised on some pop music, and I love the fact that you always have the great melodies. And sometimes, even if it's a darker song, there's kind of an uplifting energy or melodic sense to it that keeps it from getting overwhelming. Is that kind of an intentional thing that seeps in there, or is that just the way it comes out?
I think it's a bit of both. I definitely still, I always still am drawn to hooks, you know, as much as I try, you know. It's funny because I feel like every song I start with, I try to, you know, sound like a Radiohead song or something. Like, I want to be super avant-garde, but for whatever reason, like, there's still a melodic influence there that I just, you know, I still am drawn to a good hook. But I also, with this record, you know, when we were in the studio, I kind of had an intentional thought to, you know, take these songs that are pretty dark and give them a little bit of a, you know, give them a bit of a groove. And, and, you know, we would, you know, take some of these quieter songs and just assume that they would be sort of the ballad of the record, but, you know, we would try them with drums and try to make them a little groovier, which is, those are the records that I'm kind of drawn to you know, there's just kind of somebody describes Cerulean as somnambulistic, which is sort of this kind of sleepwalking. There's kind of this constant pulse to it. And I find that those are the records that I put on. You know, I've been I listen to a lot of Kurt Vile. I listen to a lot of, you know, War on Drugs, and they all kind of have this kind of steady pulse to them. And so that was an intentional idea with this record, was to take these super, super dark songs and give them a little juice, you know.
You talked in there about shopping around your record. I think all your records have been pretty much self-released, right? Like you haven't had too much help putting out any of these records, I don't think, right? Is that an intentional thing, or is it just not the right partner come out yet?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say it's intentional. I mean, every record I make, I shop around, and, you know, I've chatted with labels before, and the last two, I did put them out with a distributor down in Nashville, which is basically kind of, you know, similar to a label, but basically, offers a label services as a distributor. But no, I mean, it's not for lack of trying. We've talked to quite a few labels, and we'll see what happens with the next one. But yeah, you know, with that stuff, it's got to be the right kind of deal. And honestly, you know, it's been over a decade now, and I've just sort of realized that it, you know, everything still kind of works the old fashioned way. Like, it's just been me just making music, getting out on the road, and word of mouth, you know, and I've kind of built the audience I have, just from that. You know, there haven't really been any, you know, obviously there's been those milestones like the Canadian Folk Music Awards and stuff like that. But in general, it's just kind of been just sort of pounding the pavement and putting out records and, you know, going out and playing them live. And that's worked for me so far. So I try not to think too much about that stuff. You know, there's always a period where I'm sending the record around to people and getting feedback on them. But you know, if that takes too long, I usually just go ahead and put it out.
Well, it's such a, I mean, nobody knows how to really make money off of music anymore. It's such an unknown these days. Like, how is it worth getting a label? Is it worth, you know, trying to get anybody involved? Is there anybody who can really make a difference, or do I just go ahead and do it myself? So there's kind of benefits to both, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a valid question. I think every artist has to ask themselves, like, what are these labels actually offering, and is it worth it? You know, is it going to be worth it in the long run? And you know, I think there are some great labels out there, and labels obviously kind of help a bit more with visibility, which I think, you know, I think is probably my biggest weakness now, is just visibility. But that's, you know, it's kind of been okay with me.
Well, you and everybody else though, right? I mean, Jim Bryson would probably tell you the exact same thing. Like,
exactly. Yeah, exactly. And he's sort of done the same thing, where he's just kind of built this career from word of mouth, and it's really worked for him, you know, and he's able to make a living doing that. And at the end of the day, that's kind of all you're doing it for, right? Like, I try to remind myself that, you know, I'm making music so I can continue to make music. So as long as that is happening, then it's fine, you know? So yeah, I'm in a place of acceptance with that, and we'll see what happens going forward. But it's been, you know, again, I've had those milestones and that validation, and I have, especially with Cerulean, kind of had this second life of finding an audience, just from word of mouth, just kind of people passing it around. And yeah, that's just been really, really fun to just kind of, you know, meet these fans organically and just feel like I'm kind of building something on my own.
So now that life is sort of normal again, and we're back out touring, I know you've got some dates lined up here for this record. What's your touring strategy kind of like? Do you have one? Do you just kind of make it up as you go? Do you have a game plan lined out for how touring works for you?
I mean, not really. Again, it's the same answer as the label answer, which is just, I've been booking myself for this whole time, and I've gotten decent at doing it. It's certainly more of a challenge post pandemic, I think, just because everybody kind of went out on the road at the same time. But no, with this one, I kind of wanted to just cover a lot of ground at once instead of breaking it up into a bunch of tours. So yeah, it's starting in Montreal and getting all the way out to Vancouver and then down the West Coast. And those are a lot of markets I haven't played since before 2020. So, yeah, it's mostly just kind of piecing a, a tour together show by show. And yeah, that's kind of not much game plan other than that. Just trying to make it all work for me, driving my Subaru and not having too long of drive times in between.
Well, it's good to have you finally coming back to Winnipeg. I mean, you were here with Jen Grant, I think, the last time. Was that your first time in Winnipeg? Have you been here before?
No, that was it. Yeah, just 2019 with Jen.
And then, so now you're coming back with Jada Kelly. Do you know Jada? Is this a longstanding friendship or just?
Yeah, I haven't known her that long. We did one show last spring and we've been kind of mutual fans of each other. We've met each other a few times at various shows and festivals. So yeah, we've been talking about doing something together for a while. And she wanted, it's been a while since she's been out on the West Coast too. So, we kind of just put our heads together on this tour and we're doing five shows together. I think we're doing Winnipeg to, Edmonton.
And then you got some other dates with other bands. You got the Good Lovelies and Martin Kerr and the Great Lakes Swimmers and stuff. Do you seek out opening act opportunities or do those things just kind of happen when they happen?
Yeah, with this tour, it just kind of happened. The venues I was talking to, you know, kind of, they already had some artists on those dates and offered them up as support. It used to be a thing I would almost solely seek out just support spots. And that was a big way I actually built an audience. And as I say, I used to do all these private shows. And that was a way to make a living doing it, but it was not. I realized kind of after doing it for years and years that it wasn't actually,
it's hard to build off of that, right?
Yeah, I wasn't really growing an audience from it. So it felt great to be out there making a living doing it, but I wasn't growing my audience at all. So I sort of switched my focus to trying to get on shows as a support act. And that made a big difference in terms of just getting in front of new audiences and trying to build the audience growth just happened a lot quicker once I started doing that.
And you're certainly busy this month judging by your calendar that you've got posted so far, but do you take long stretches between tours? Like do you need a lot of time off to recuperate, or is it just kind of, again, how it works out?
I never used to. No, I used to just, I'd have a bag packed all the time and I felt like it was just like, I'd be home for a week and then gone for a week. And that was kind of how I did it for years. And then, now it's a little harder to leave the house. So I'm trying to kind of space, you know, again, kind of do all the touring at once and having more of a break in between. Cause I just got used to being at home and making music at home, and that's, I'm really enjoying that. And, you know, I love being out on the road too. It's just, I find the actual leaving part is getting harder. Just the walking out the door.
And is that because you're sort of afraid of not being around those comforts of home anymore? Or is it, the uncertainties of your job? Or
I think I'm just a little more settled now. And we're out in the country now and have a bit more space. And my wife and I. And I think just kind of got into more of a routine of making music from home. So it's kind of started to, just get settled in that a bit. But again, I love being out on the road. And once I'm out on the road, you kind of get in that zone. And again, you kind of realize how many, you know, you get to see all your friends in different cities, you know, like you realize how many people you don't see if you're at home all the time. And that's kind of the beauty of this job, is you get to go out and see all these people that, you know, you haven't seen for years. And it's a great way to connect with other people. But, I think just, you know, 2 years at home kind of makes it harder. But, I'm psyched to get back out on the road.
Well, that's good. And you mentioned already that you already have another batch of songs for another record after this one. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm working on it. I'm about halfway there. So I'm hoping by the end of the year, I'll have a new record in hand, and well, not in hand, but new songs in hand and a plan going forward with what I'm going to do with it. So yeah, it took a while to to get back. It's, there's always that, like, you finish, you release one record and then you have zero songs and you're like, oh my God, how am I ever going to write another record? And then it kind of just starts to, the wheel starts spinning again after a while, but there's usually a big gap where you just don't write anything and everything is a struggle. And, yeah. And then eventually, yeah.
Do you feel like you have to kind of do something different with each record? Is there some sort of something that you want to change, or are you worried about, you know, them being too similar, or are you?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's always, I always ask myself the question of like, what do I want the next record to be about? And I don't necessarily write every song with an intention of thinking like what, you know, where is it going to fit in the grand scheme of the next album? But there is sort of this intention of like, what's next? What do you want to write about next? What's going on in your life now that wasn't going on when you wrote the last record? And then again, yeah, I find after with every record, you just kind of take more and more risks, at least with arrangements, and you just get to take more liberties and you've got more experience with making a record. So it becomes more and more fun to make them, for sure. And especially now that I'm able to, you know, at least make like a decent sounding demo from home and actually like kind of arrange songs on my own. I never used to arrange anything. I used to just bring a song in, you know, play it on acoustic guitar and have Jim or whichever producer arrange it from there. But now I'm starting to dabble in that more, which is a lot more fun for me. And but yeah, so again, I think the next record's gonna be a little more up tempo, a little more hopeful. So I'm looking forward to that. I'll be holding your
hand when the big one comes. Thanks to Ken Yates for taking the time to chat and to help reboot this podcast. Thanks to Jared and the great Ken Beattie at Killbeat Music for helping to line it up for me. If you're in Winnipeg, I hope to see you at the West End Cultural Center on October 15th for Ken Yates and Jada Kelly. If you want to find out where else you can find Ken or find out more information, go to kenyates.com or go to flywithyourshadow.com for links, more information, and past episodes of the show. This show is and always will be free. We don't have any ads. We don't ever ask you for money. The one thing that you could do to help support the show is to share this episode with people who might enjoy it. Finding new listeners is always a challenge, so your help in spreading the word would be greatly appreciated. I really love hearing from listeners. If you have any questions or comments or feedback or suggestions, or you want to suggest a future guest for the show, drop me a line at flywithyourshadow.com. You can also hear me on a radio show called Tell the Band to Go Home, which you can find at tellthebandtogohome.com or in Winnipeg on UMFM Sunday afternoons at 2. My name is Jeff Robson. I sincerely thank you for taking the time to listen. I hope you'll join me again on the next episode of Fly With Your Shadow, which will hopefully not take 2 years. I hope to be back soon with another great conversation.